Welcome back to Ars Politica podcast. Today, I'm going to read the speech that I gave on June 7th, 2024 in Ogden, Utah at the New Christendom Conference. So let me get right into it. The title is Against Multiculturalism. Nothing about our thinking on ethnicity is normal. We Westerners are weird. We are unlike the rest of the world. Most people around the world, whether Christian or not, have a distinct people, some group to which they strongly belong, which has outgroups and often enemies. The strong feeling of peoplehood is true for a significant portion of those who make their living in the United States, whose bodies are in the U.S., but whose hearts remain in Mexico, Africa, the Vatican, or the Levant. A nation of immigrants can be nothing less than a hodgepodge of groups from somewhere other than the soil they currently depend on. America is the universal place, a space for everyone, a no place. It is good only because everything about it is derivative. Nothing is from here except the Native Americans or American Indians, the only people group granted true rootedness with that term native or natus, Latin for born or arisen. America is a land for people whose place lies on foreign shores. And to be truly American is to fight and even die to make this land a no place, a geographic space, an economic zone for any and all. There is no distinct American ethnicity, or so we're told. America is the universal nation, rendered good not by settled hearts, nor by a culturally bound people. It requires that you affirm some universal abstract propositions. Say that everyone gets to decide for himself the meaning of existence. But that's basically it. The deeper meaning of life, the sort of things that the heart owns, such as ethnic identity, cultural particularity, or strong connection of people and place, must be supplied and rooted outside of America. Thus, the true Americans in the new America are the hyphenated Americans. In a sense, these people are more complete human beings than the unhyphenated. They have settled hearts with a people and place, albeit a foreign place, while the unhyphenated have no place of their own. But we, the unhyphenated, those who trace our ancestry to Western Europe, whose roots extend beyond the Immigration Act of 1965 and Ellis Island, and which unite to this soil, we, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants who founded, built, died for, and led this country for most of its history, we are not permitted in this new America to have a people or a place that is distinctly ours. There is no distant place that we call home. We have nowhere else to go. This is our home. This is our native land. We are Native Americans, born of those who didn't immigrate but settled here. We are the sons and daughters of the people who settled this land. To describe America as a nation of immigrants, writes the great Harvard political scientist Samuel Huntington, is to stretch a partial truth into a misleading falsehood and to ignore the central fact of America's beginning as a society of settlers. Yet the country that our ancestors built is no longer for those whose hearts are settled here. It is not for those whose people are old stock Americans, whose people as a group were generated before, during, and soon after the American founding. We are not permitted to identify with this ancestry, in any strong sense at least. You cannot call yourself a heritage American. In a word, you cannot have a people like everyone else. And why is that? Because through them, you could lay claim to this country. Indeed, the whole point of the nation of immigrants trope is to render this old stock American claim irrelevant and anti-American, and even to elevate the hyphenated over the unhyphenated as more American. To be sure, we are allowed to have a people to which we act for good, and this speaks directly to one main point of this talk. The people we are granted and unthinkingly accept is composed of all people, anyone and everyone who is here, who fits within the geographical boundaries. That is, our people has been universalized, leaving us nothing positive that is exclusively ours, unlike everyone else who retains full rights to a shared, particular feeling of people and place. The sociologist Eric Kaufman calls this asymmetric multiculturalism. It refers to social arrangements in which every ethnic identity deserves celebration, except any white ethnic identity. In my view, this is just what multiculturalism is. It is inherently asymmetrical by design. We should distinguish it from the idea of multi-ethnic, in which various ethnic groups exist under the same civil polity. There's nothing new in that. However, multiculturalism, as Paul Gottfried defines it, is when, quote, the state glorifies differences from the way of life associated with the once majority population. It hands out rewards to those who personify the desired differences, while taking away cultural recognition and even political rights from those who do not, end quote. As defined here, multiculturalism is the official policy of the American regime. It is reflected in everything from the protected classes and the application of civil rights law to the accepted societal rhetoric around race and ethnicity. Everyone but white people can self-consciously and publicly have a bounded people in place for whom they openly act for their good. White people in the Western world, and this is crucial, are their own in-groups out-group. They are their own in-groups out-group. Now, what do I mean by this? First, an in-group consists of those to whom you direct your affections and thoughts and principal actions for their good. An out-group may or may not be hostile, but it consists of those to whom you do not ordinarily direct your affections, thoughts, and principal actions. Now, the in-group for white people in America, as I said earlier, is composed of all people. If you are human, then you are in. Our in-group is not white or Anglo-Saxon in-group. It extends to all. Keep that in mind. It's very important. Now, we must begin to recognize that we are the out-group of that in-group. We are the hostile out-group, our history's oppressor. We old-stock Americans are that group from which all others had to overcome to gain their freedom. We are our own nation's villain. Thus, our in-group, which again is universalized to all people, is full of protected classes. And they need protection from whom? From whom are they protected? From white people. And to be more specific, the white heterosexual male. So seeking the good of our own in-group, which I must stress, extends to all people, not whites alone, is precisely found in villainizing ourselves, effectively making us the out-group of our own in-group. Let me read it again. Seeking the good of our in-group, which again extends to all people, not whites alone, is precisely found in villainizing ourselves, effectively making us the out-group of our own in-group. We must view ourselves as the obstacle to our in-group's flourishing. That is, white people must view themselves as the obstacle to their in-group's flourishing. The entire American regime and all acceptable public discourse follows from and confirms this. It follows that we, as a group, cannot stand up for ourselves. Take even a recent positive development in opposing anti-white discrimination in university admissions. University admissions, when they seek to create a diverse student body, must discriminate against white applicants because whites are second only to Asians in grades and test scores. Almost every racial diversity program must, at least in effect, harm white people. Diversity is code for fewer white heterosexual men. Every single time. Every time you see diversity, think fewer white men. Now, maximal diversity is the absence of straight white men. Given the sheer number of white applicants for college admission, whites are the most discriminated against. How do we respond? If we respond at all, how do we argue against this discrimination? Not by referring to discrimination against us. Indeed, since we cannot see ourselves as a distinct group, we cannot be a protected class. We instead must point to discrimination against Asians. In recent Supreme Court cases, this is precisely what happened. A recent Supreme Court case brought against UNC Chapel Hill and Harvard was brought on behalf of Asian Americans, not whites. This despite the fact that whites are, by population, far more subject to discrimination. Jeremy Carl, author of the book The Unprotected Class, which I highly recommend, writes, quote, that Asian American students would be seen as a more appealing client to a Supreme Court with no Asian Americans, but stocked with a majority of white conservatives, is a very revealing window into our racial politics today. The media took notice, of course. One professor, cited by Jeremy Carl, says, quote, all the research shows it's white Americans would benefit the most from ruling against factoring race in admissions. The professor was implying, of course, that white Americans benefiting from a policy is bad. Anything that benefits whites is bad, even if it comes from all being treated equally. Indeed, once you're aware of this rhetorical move, that anything that benefits whites more than non-whites is bad, you'll see this rhetorical move everywhere. Anything that harms whites for the good of non-whites is good. And such harm is questionable only if it also harms non-whites. If university admissions only harmed whites and not Asians, would anyone fuss about it? Probably not. Would anyone care if you did? Probably not. What I'm describing here are not simply the views or rhetorical strategies of communists, socialists, or modern liberals. This is also the rhetoric of American conservatives. Even for conservatives, whites are their own in-groups, out-group. Take the typical conservative narrative of American history. The conservative narrative is actually far more progressive than the left-wing progressives narrative. In essence, America, according to the conservative historian, has overcome the dominance of the white Protestant male, as we've slowly extended rights to non-whites and non-white males. Their overcoming theme is this, their overarching theme is this. The American founding issued a promise, and the white male fulfilled it by overcoming himself. Fulfilling the promise of the founding is simply the positive way of saying that white males overcame themselves. Most conservatives will simply pick a recent year from which to command history to stop progressing. But inevitably, their highly respected friend, someone like Jonah Goldberg, will write the next The Conservative Case For article that updates their timeless principles, ensuring that they remain the controlled opposition. Of course, the progress doesn't stop. A narrative built on progress never stops. There is no end of history for a progressive national narrative. Thus, even for the conservative, white people are their own in-groups, out-group. And the conservative's historical narrative assumes and perpetuates it. Fulfilling the promises of the founding, the promises made by your ancestors to all, so we're told, requires you to assume the ancestral promise as your own, to identify with that all, and then to cast your ancestors and yourself as the villain of our nation's history, but also its hero. And in so doing, you must affirm and celebrate everyone's diversity except your own. Again, you take upon yourself the burden of your ancestors' promise, and you fulfill it by overcoming and villainizing yourself on behalf of all. You become the sacrificial hero, resulting in your displacement, a deracinated heart, and the loss of self-respect and a self-affirming people of your own. Now, multiculturalism is animated by a sort of social pathology. It is pathology because multiculturalism is demonstrably bad for the majority by every measure and by everyday experience. Yet it remains in the U.S., and especially among majorities, the majorities of European countries, the central theme of policy and political rhetoric. What's incredible about this, what is so weird about it all, is that even liberal academics have shown conclusively that multiculturalism undermines social trust. It distances people from one another, diminishes social capital and civic engagement. A 2020 study published by the Annual Review of Political Science looked at 1,001 statistical estimates on ethnic diversity and social trust from 87 different studies, and it concluded, quote, "We find a negative relationship between ethnic diversity and social trust across all studies. The relationship is stronger for trust in neighbors when studied in more local contexts." George Mason University economist Garrett Jones, in his book The Culture Transplant, concludes, "The message here is clear. When it comes to social trust, greater ethnic diversity is a weakness." Studies also demonstrate that ethnic diversity harms a sense of the common good. A 2011 study concluded, quote, ethnic diversity seems to lead to a shift from public spending on public goods to the public provision of private goods, arguably because the latter can be targeted to particular ethnic groups. In other words, ethnic unity or cultural homogeneity correlates with the willingness to pay taxes for the common good. That is, to the sort of things that benefit all, such as good roads. And ethnic diversity, however, leads to increased spending on ethnic targeted goods like scholarships or government jobs or business loans designated for particular groups. All of that should sound familiar. It's basically the Democratic platform today, which is explicitly favors its non-white, ethnically diverse clientele with targeted programs, notably business loans and welfare programs, disproportionately used by non-white groups. We Westerners do not deeply appreciate how good we've had it with a culture strongly opposed to corruption and graft and bribery and adamant about procedure following in civic institutions and bureaucracies. Though imperfect, we're still exceptionally altruistic. We follow the rules. We wait our turn in line. We don't cheat to get ahead. And we expect, as a matter of moral principle, that no public official has personal favorites for government services intended for all. But that way of life is increasingly vanishing. One culture shock you hear from American missionaries is the surprising toleration of corruption in foreign countries. It is almost ubiquitous. Missionaries often find themselves justifying paying off bribes since there's no other way to continue their activities. To get things done, say register a vehicle or get permits, or to avoid frivolous legal demands or threats of lawsuits, it is easier to pay a fixer who himself is not a government employee but is connected to a co-ethnic who then gets the job done. This foreign way of doing things has arrived in America. One writer, Matthew Crawford, the author of the bestseller Shop Class as Soulcraft, recently wrote on his experience in the California DMV. He writes, and I quote at length, "In dropping the pretense of his ostensible mission of public safety, the official DMV was perhaps just acknowledging the reality of the unofficial DMV, the one that is likely to be called corrupt by people clinging to first world norms. Having now spent some time in DMV offices in the New California, my impression is that the shop floor operates along the lines of ethnic fiefdoms that overlap somewhat and work fairly smoothly together when necessary. The Hispanic customers speak their own language with a Hispanic teller, the warm tones and easy gestures of which seem very unlike the bureaucratic mode of address that institutional English is adapted to. There are other languages spoken as well, each with its own characteristic emotional repertoire. Some of these seem better adapted to the haggle, at least to the naive and suspicious ear of one feeling beset by cacophonous babble. You Tinder reader might be scandalized by the ways of California's DMV, but such a response is a hangover from another era. Under conditions of bureaucratic dysfunction, corruption isn't a problem. It is the solution. These new populations have found ways to get things done. Bribery is more efficient and far less crazy-making than clinging to first-world expectations in a world that has changed," end quote. What this speaks to is not simply the natural results of bureaucracy amidst multiculturalism, but the quite predictable failure of assimilation of foreigners into Western norms of altruism, universalism, and proceduralism. Social scientists have shown quite conclusively that immigrants in the West retain the values of their ancestral homeland. Again, Garrett Jones summarizes the findings. On average, hyphenated Americans appear to get about half of their attitudes towards social trust from the land that comes before the hyphen, persisting to the fourth generation. The ethnocentrism of many people here will simply not diminish. Thus, Indians in America, having a strong culture of nepotism and ethnocentrism, will hire their own, even abusing the H-1B visa program as we see in the tech industry. Furthermore, the values that tend towards lower socioeconomic performance will endure for generations. In short, if you import the third world, you get third worldification. That is not far-right rhetoric, but statistical, demonstrated fact. There is every reason to believe that the importation of tens of millions through the southern border will create a socioeconomic underclass that will, over time, shape our institutions into those of their ancestral lands. That is, into ethnic privileging, corruption, procedural dysfunction, and most importantly, the utter failure to serve the actual common good. Instead, you get perfunctory licensing and certification, shoddy structural inspections, unreliable contracts, meaningless and dangerous credentialism, class-based politicking, and the weaponization of the legal system. So let's bring this down to earth for a moment. The most beloved of American cultural practices, one that sets us apart from the world, is the American culture of smiling and of acknowledging the passerby and strangers. That pleasantry makes the public pleasant, a livable and welcoming place. It feels like a duty to us. This is just one of the many cultural practices that are eroding and will endure in multiculturalism. What Edmund Burke once called the decent drapery of life that beautify and soften society will be dissolved, making the public a space of cold and gray utility. What was once the predicted consequence of capitalism will actually be the result of multiculturalism. Since 2010, researchers have begun to show that the people matter much more than the place in determining social trust, prosperity, good governance, and technological advancement. This is certainly true of Southeast Asian countries with their strong Chinese minorities, always economically on top over the more indigenous, no matter how long they've resided there. But this is also true of Europeans. Economists from Brown University, David Weil and Lewis Putterman, in a pathbreaking study argued this, and I quote, "If the only thing you knew about each nation on the planet was the fraction of that nation with ancestors of European descent, you'd be able to predict 2/3 of all global income differences." That's as summarized by Garrett Jones. A growing body of research indicates that the people matter more than the place. In other words, if thousands of Chinese immigrated to Africa, Africa would likely improve on all economic and governmental indicators. The point here is not to prove some genetic supremacy, but to simply point out that regardless of the cause, the data show that descendants of Europeans produce more prosperous countries, and I will add better governance and technological advancement, rivaled only by East Asians, namely the Chinese. We can conclude, therefore, that if we rely on reason rather than emotion, that reducing the European composition of any country will, unless replaced by the Chinese, will harm the well-being of that country and certainly undermine the Western character of their institutions. Now, most Westerners already know this, at least implicitly, from experience, and they can access the studies confirming that experience. But we can't end our love affair with multiculturalism. Western ethnomasochism, the perverse thrill in experiencing cultural suicide, is radically new and exclusive to our time. It would be almost incommunicable to our forefathers. Guilt, it seems to me, is the crucial factor in our weirdness, but it is not the sole factor. Guilt interacts with Western universalism and egalitarianism, the same traits that have produced our prosperity, good governance, and selfless public service. This proves to be a suicidal admixture. Westerners tend to think that they live in universal space, a purely human place, fit and suitable for all. We think that the capitalist system is not undergirded by strong cultural norms, that bureaucracy is a matter of universal reason and rationalization, that everyone has the same rights which are easily taught and received, and everyone is equal and free. It's a human space, not dependent on a common way of life to function and endure. Thus, many ways of life can and should equally flourish. And so, we adamantly affirm against all experience. Guilt arises, however, when these conditions produce disparities of outcomes. We don't wake up from our ideological slumber, realizing the conditions for flourishing are not universal, but undergirded by a particular way of life of a particular people. No, we blame ourselves for not establishing the universal, for not yet rooting out the implicit biases and our implicit supremacy in the system. So we utilize guilt to cope with the failure of our ideology to successfully universalize. Again, we are our own in-group's out-group. Instead of rejecting this ideology, recognizing that our way of life is what undergirds our system, that is, instead of affirming our true in-group, our guilt causes us to reaffirm the universalist and radically egalitarian ideology to double down. In psychological terms, our guilt suppresses the cognitive dissonance between ideology and experience. For this reason, Multiculturalism, among other destructive and delusional policies, continue. The final resolution of this purification spiral is complete dispossession. What begins with dispossessed hearts ends with dispossessed bodies. Universalism and guilt together shape the way we morally evaluate ourselves and others. At the group level, you may ascribe to white people only negative qualities, but you may ascribe to non-whites only positive qualities. Any negative qualities found among non-whites, in terms of patterns and averages, must be redirected and blamed on whites. We take on the guilt of their moral crimes. That is, we blame ourselves. Their sins, we might say, are imputed to us, reckoned to ourselves, and we take them on willingly. We wound ourselves for their transgressions. This is all quite absurd when aired in the open, but isn't this precisely what we find in public life? White guilt leads to self-accusation, which serves as the feedback mechanism that perpetuates and exacerbates the already failed policies of multiculturalism. The sex crimes in Europe, for example, have soared following recent immigration from the Middle East and Africa. In Sweden, nearly half of those convicted of rape were born outside the country. Yet the reception of foreigners continues unabated. On New Year's Eve in 2015 in Cologne, Germany, during celebrations, around 1,200 women in the main square were sexually assaulted and robbed. This same thing happened in Hamburg and Stuttgart. And as Douglas Murray reports, the police in all these places, as they have almost everywhere in Europe, sought to conceal the ethnic identities of the perpetrators. Murray writes, quote, "There appeared to be a concrete official effort to suppress data about crimes where the suspects might be migrants." Recently, a German woman, Marie Theresa Kaiser, was convicted and fined 6,000 euros in a German court for, quote, "inciting hatred." What did she do? She posted on social media the statistically established fact that Afghanis in Germany are heavily involved in gang rape. So if you post facts about sacred protected groups, you must pay the price. All this comes after the infamous Rotterdam child sex exploitation scandal, in which Pakistanis in England from 1980s to 2013 assaulted thousands of teenage white British girls. The local authorities knew about it for decades, stretching back to the 80s. And they did almost nothing, fearing charges of racism. Even after a crackdown, which has resulted in only 46 convictions, with most sentences less than 15 years, the problem persists. A report from 2022 cites, quote, "institutional hesitancy to intervene and take the necessary action to protect children and catch perpetrators." Has the UK learned its lesson? Around 83,000 Pakistanis immigrated legally to the UK in 2023. Has Europe learned its lesson? No, mass immigration continues. In multiculturalism, as I've said, anything you ascribe to minority groups as groups must be positive. It follows that if any individual does something bad, he must be considered as an individual, not representative of the minority group. This is true regardless of the obvious noticeable patterns. In contrast, the majority group in a nation, in our case whites, are treated as disparate individuals when doing good things, or we say that their great deeds are acts of humanity. They're either individualized or maximally universalized. Their great deeds do not represent something about their ethnic group or race. But of course, any evil they do is representative of their group, even requiring us all to stop and reflect. So Derek Chauvin, with his knee on George Floyd, requires us to reflect on our collective racism. Meanwhile, Daryl Brooks, the black man who drove through the Waukesha Christmas parade in 2021, killing 6 white people, including 8-year-old Jackson Sparks. Jackson Sparks, a boy marching with his baseball team. Daryl Brooks was simply a lone sociopath, angry at his girlfriend, so we're told. Just this last Monday, a black woman outside an Ohio supermarket targeted and fatally stabbed a 3-year-old white boy, Julian Wood, next to his mother, who also suffered injuries. The boy died in his mother's arms, a mother doing nothing but minding her own business. Will we take to the streets over these incidents? Are we willing to notice let alone denounce black-on-white crime. No. This murderer is just an individual, representing nothing but herself. However, the very few instances of whites murdering blacks occasions our natural reflection, even when they occurred decades ago. You're required to reflect on the name Emmett Till every time you hear it, a black teenager killed in 1955. But will anyone require you to remember the name Julian Wood, or Jackson Sparks, or any of the tens of thousands of whites killed by blacks over the last few decades? No. The far more numerous cases of blacks murdering whites causes not a stir at all. The justifiable death of a black man by cops is a national event, usually creating new slogans and a new civil rights hero, while the execution-style killing of white cops by black men generates no national buzz, only a local ceremony. There is something wrong with us. Do you not see how utterly perverse this is? But it's an emblem. It's emblematic of a much broader problem in the West. One striking example of this majority-minority double standard comes out of Germany. In 2016, three migrants raped a German woman. At first, she lied about their ethnic identities, calling them German nationals because she didn't want to, quote, help fuel aggressive racism. She then published an open letter to her attackers, and this one paragraph is worth reading in full. She writes, "I wanted an open Europe, a friendly one, one that I can gladly live in, and one in which we are both safe in. I am sorry. For us both, I am so incredibly sorry. You aren't safe here because we live in a racist society. I am not safe here because we live in a sexist society. But what truly makes me feel sorry are the circumstances by which the sexist and the boundary-crossing acts that were inflicted on me make it so that you are beset by increasing and more aggressive racism." Again, she's talking to her attackers here. "I promise you, I will scream. I will not allow it that this continues happening. I will not stand by idly and watch as racist and concerned citizens call you a problem. You are not the problem. You are not a problem at all. You most often are a wonderful human being who deserves to be free and safe like everyone else." Of course, this is insane, but I want to suggest that fundamentally this psychology, in more subtle forms, prevails in the West, including in the United States. The Western civilizational ethos can be characterized by maximal openness to outsiders. Our civilization be nothing distinctive in itself, but a universal human space for any and all outside of it. And we as Westerners, as those who must embody this ethos, must likewise be radically open to the point of being nothing distinctive in ourselves, having nothing of ourselves to self-affirm, be proud of, to recognize as uniquely ours. The great books of the Western canon, for example, are not ours, but, quote, humanities, chosen not because they are our inheritance, but on account of their objective universal worth. They are everybody's, so we tell ourselves. Thus, we have nothing that is uniquely ours except a self-police duty to cultivate the places and things of the West for outsiders, for the great non-Western other, and for them to be something. So great is the Western malaise that we are great only insofar that they become great. We must decrease that they might increase. Our only good is doing good to the non-Westerner, and so our confidence, our worth, and our meaning is tied up with those extra nos outside of us. We live vicariously through the self-affirmation and self-confidence of the other. In this sense, we are dependent on the non-Westerner to be good, on their self-assurance and confidence. We live through them. When humans have nothing of and for themselves, they find it from others. This is the function of the great white gaze. It is a desperate and pathetic attempt to feel human. But let's focus back on America. The post-World War II order brought in a new history of America, one that emphasized the U.S. as a nation of immigrants, a nation for any and all who will affirm our liberal propositions. But this narrative is false. The post-war period is an era of myth creation. The never-again ethos, which rose to dominate after World War II, required that the political left and right affirm a new narrative of American history. In the U.S., this story is centered in part around two seemingly contradictory ideas: that the American political tradition is racist, or contains racism, and is marked by radical openness. Both the left and the right accepted versions of these. The left believes that America is racist to its core, a racism that continues to manifest everywhere and explains everything. The left's solution to racism is radical openness through diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI. Similarly, the American center-right will dutifully recognize America's racist heritage, but insist that racism always contradicted America's core ideals, namely the universalistic, radical openness of the American founding. America has improved, according to the center-right, but only by fulfilling the promise of the founding, namely through radical openness, that is, diversity, equality, and inclusion, or DEI. Thus, both the right and the left are fully committed to radical openness. The left defeats racism through openness, and the right denies American racism with the historical narrative of progressive openness. They differ in their principles, but agree in the means and ends. Central to this narrative is the idea that America is, at some level, a propositional nation, or at least, it is a country whose unifying theme transcends ethnic and cultural difference. Indeed, the greater the diversity, the greater the theme's glory. The more that America looks like the multi-ethnic eschaton, the more marvelous and divine are its principles. Of course, ethnicity can mean a great deal to Americans, but only if their ethnicity lays no claim to be the core ethnos around which all others derive their Americanness. This post-war ethos explains why the conservatives in the 1980s sought to universalize or dehistoricize the Pilgrims of Plymouth Rock, making them the archetype of the cosmopolitan, freedom-loving, huddled masses that would come to form our nation of immigrants. Reagan's mythologizing about the city on a hill is old news, mostly false, and seared permanently in the boomer's mind by cable television. But alive and well is the myth that Americans were never a singular ethnos. Any emphasis on identity rooted in intergenerational love and action for ourselves and our posterity is suppressed and considered un-American. It's denounced as nativism. America was never a nation of shared ancestry, blood, and religion, so we're told. Belonging to America has little to do with generational linkages of the dead, living, and unborn to a shared ancestral history. Rather, we're told that American unity is a more universal history, a commitment to shared abstract ideals. One belongs by virtue of affirming a shared creed. Now, this narrative seems innocuous enough. The overarching theme is altruistic action for humanity with struggle against various forms of oppression. American identity is fundamentally the human struggle against the abstract human oppressor. However innocuous, it still renders the core American identity a negative or oppositional identity. Being a good American is simply identifying with and advancing the history of overcoming the oppressor. But we must recognize that the chief oppressor in this drama is none other than the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, or to update it a bit, the white heterosexual man. His intersection of characteristics renders him the villain in every case of oppression in American history. And this is his only distinctive identity in American history. For the WASP, as they've been called, cannot have a positive identity, nor can he claim a unique and important connection to the American Anglo-Protestants of old, such as George Washington. Washington and all great American Anglo-Protestants of our history have been universalized and thus have become fathers of all. We're left with no heroes to call our own. But given the oppositional nature of this historical narrative, non-Anglo-Protestants, having been the oppressed, can exclusively identify with their ancestry. So one can be proud of being Black, Hispanic, Chinese, and have exclusive claims to certain American heroes, such as MLK is for Blacks. But this is denied to white Protestant Americans, whose potential heroes have been universalized or villainized. They are not allowed to have a distinct people. Again, their in-group is all people. But since their ancestors were the oppressors in American history, they are their own in-group's out-group. Thus, they are connected to their ancestry exclusively, but only as they are the villains of American history. The exact opposite is true of all other groups. The turn against the WASP is a dark irony, for there is a grain of truth to the myth of American openness. Americans have always been remarkably open and welcoming relative to the rest of the world. But until very recently, American openness was highly conditional. It required ethnic conformity. Indeed, American openness was not the toleration of radical difference as many conceive of it today. It wasn't radical toleration, but radical conformity. Foreigners became natives by becoming like the natives. American openness was the belief that foreigners, at least their progeny, can assimilate into the American ethnos, namely into Anglo-Protestantism. Contrary to popular belief, there was an ethnic basis to American identity during the founding, which endured well after it, well into the 20th century. There was a dominant ethnicity. Furthermore, solidarity around this uniquely American ethnos was necessary to maintain America's universal principles. Ethnic particularity ensured the survival of universal principles. Culture undergirded the viability of the propositions. And this self-confident and dominant Anglo-Protestant ethnos lasted well into the 20th century, and I think implicitly persists in American life to this day. Now, at the time of the founding, the American population was 80% British and 98% Protestant. Though there were distinct English cultural regions in North America, they were already self-consciously American well before the American founding. Historians Alan Gelzo and Gordon Wood have separately pointed to the Great Awakening as the initial cause of this sort of ethnogenesis. Another researcher, Eric Kaufman, calls it the early stages of a British-American self-consciousness. The Americans consider themselves part of the British political tradition. For example, in its 1774 Declaration and Resolves, the Continental Congress sought recognition of their rights according to the immutable laws of nature, the principles of the English Constitution, and the several charters or compacts, end quote. They declared that these rights, quote, as Englishmen, as their ancestors, in like cases have usually done for asserting and vindicating their rights and liberties. Thus, they sought their rights, some being natural and others civil, according to the manner of their particular ethnic tradition, as Englishmen. We see here the universal and the particular, the latter being necessary to maintain the former. Old English liberties codified and symbolized in the Magna Carta were frequently asserted, most earnestly by figures like Samuel Adams. Even the Declaration of Independence, though emphasized today for its universalistic language, closes its list of grievances by appealing to their British brethren, accusing the king of being deaf to the voice of consanguinity, that is, deaf to those of shared blood. And of course, the preamble of the Constitution identifies its chief end, quote, the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Among the founding generation and well into the 20th century, Americans affirmed a sort of Anglo-Saxonism, linking the American spirit of liberty to the Saxon liberties of old. Thomas Jefferson was the most insistent in this regard. Americans were, quote, led by Hengist and Horsa, the Saxon chiefs from whom we claim the honor of being descended and whose political principles and form of government we have assumed. In another place, he writes, has not every restitution of the ancient Saxon had happy effects? Is it not better now that we return at once into that happy system of our ancestors, the wisest and most perfect yet ever devised by the wit of man, as it stood before the 8th century? This animating myth that Americans were the immigrated remnants of the Anglo-Saxons was also articulated by Benjamin Franklin and Charles Carroll, and later by popular 19th century American historians such as George Bancroft and William Prescott. Anglo-Saxonism is found in the works of Walt Whitman, Henry Adams, Henry Cabot Lodge, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and Jack London, for example, his novel Valley of the Moon, one of my favorites. Of course, Anglo-Saxonism is more myth than fact, but it speaks nevertheless to the idea of an intertwining of ethnicity, ancestry, and American principles, and was affirmed even by those who insisted on the universality of those principles. Eric Kaufman mentioned earlier, argues that this American Anglo-Saxonism was similar to the romantic nationalist ideas of later continental Europe, such as Johann Herder, Hegel, and Fichte. One crucial question following the War of Independence was the possibility of political unity among the former colonies. As I said, there was self-conscious Americanness prior to the war, but the war itself completed that unity. Indeed, their mutually shared struggle was appealed to in key times to justify a stronger national government. John Jay's line in Federalist 2 is likely the most famous. A people descended from the same, this is the quote, a people descended from the same ancestors, speaking the same language, professing the same religion, attached to the same principles of government, very similar in their manners and customs, and who, by their joint councils, arms, and efforts, fighting side by side throughout a long and bloody war, have nobly established general liberty and independence. Less known is a line from George Washington's 1796 farewell address. Quote, with slight shades of difference, you have the same religion, manners, habits, and political principles. You have in common causes fought and triumphed together. The independence and liberty you possess are the work of joint councils and joint efforts, of common dangers, sufferings, and successes. Both Washington and Jay were not simply stating facts, but arguing for the feasibility of political unity by direct appeal to cultural homogeneity or cultural similarity. And in so doing, they acknowledged a crucial principle that cultural similarity is necessary for political unity. Affirming universal propositions was not enough. Now, the famous French commentator on the early Republic, Alexis de Tocqueville, is often trotted out to confront this argument. He claimed that America is, quote, a society formed of all nations of the world. This is clearly an exaggeration, as he admits elsewhere, that, quote, there is hardly an American to be met with who does not claim some remote kindred with the first founders of the colonies. That is, the colonies, not the country, colonies. Contrary to Tocqueville's claim, the founders and the American people were not keen on diversity, immigration, and ethnic difference. Franklin was famously hostile to the German immigrants and wanted to limit their number in order to Anglify them more effectively. Franklin even co-founded the organization subtly named the Society for Propagating Christian Knowledge Among Germans. Thomas Jefferson feared that that European immigration would, quote, render America a heterogeneous, incoherent, distracted mass, which is what we've, well, ironically for our time, given recent pop culture, Alexander Hamilton was adamantly against non-Anglo immigration. He writes, quote, the safety of a republic depends essentially on the energy of a common national sentiment and on that love of country which will almost invariably be connected with birth, education, and family. Foreigners will generally be apt to bring with them attachments to the persons they have left behind, to the country of their nativity, and to its particular customs and manners. They will also entertain opinions of government congenial with those under which they have lived, or if they should be led hither from a preference to ours, how extremely unlikely is it that they will bring with them that temperate love of liberty so essential to real republicanism? As we saw earlier, these obviously true and ancient claims are confirmed by social science. Finally, James Madison spoke of Americans as having, quote, kindred blood, such that they can live together as members of the same family. He wanted limited immigration only to those who, quote, really meant to incorporate into our society, end quote. That is, those who will assimilate to the American Anglo-Protestant ethnicity. All this comes from the great political theorists of the American Creed. Were they wildly inconsistent? No. While they affirm that natural rights are universal rights, they believe that liberty was made possible by underlying cultural conditions. It is not sufficient to simply affirm universal principles of liberty. In order for such principles to abide and produce concrete good in society, the people must be prepared for them. Take this striking statement by founding father Gouverneur Morris, who was the U.S. ambassador to France in 1792, 3 years after the French Revolution. He's talking about the French here. Keep that in mind, and I quote, in effect, time is needful to bring forward slaves to the enjoyment of liberty. Time, education. But what is education? It is not learning. It is more the effect of society on the habits and principles of each individual, forming him at an early period of life to act afterwards the part of a good citizen and contribute in his turn to the formation of others. Hence it results that the progress towards freedom must be slow, end quote. The founders, though generally open and optimistic toward newcomers, affirm that culture undergirded the proper exercising of universal natural rights. Those who lacked the culture cannot properly exercise the rights and will ultimately undermine the rights of others. This view was likely the majority position in this country until perhaps 1965, and it lives on, for the most part, unspokenly today, and is reflected in immigration policy throughout our history. For most of our history, there was a core dominant ethnicity that was distinctly American, rooted in Anglo-Protestantism, and it was confidently dominant in that it demanded that newcomers conform to it. Some of the strongest, most popular and effective political movements in the 19th century and the early 20th century were grounded in this. So you think of Booker T. Washington. Also, the Know-Nothing movement, which is derided today, but was widely popular and likely would have achieved significant political success in the 19th century had its energy not been subsumed by the emerging Republican Party and also debates over slavery. Americans would shout, "Native Americans, beware of foreign influence." The great Princeton theologian Charles Hodge said this, and I quote, "If it be then the distinction of Anglo-Saxon Christians that they are a Sabbath-keeping people, it is one to be highly prized and sedulously guarded. And in this country especially, we should be watchful lest the influx of immigrants of other nationalities deprive us of this great distinction and its blessing." A little later, Henry Cabot Lodge appealed to the Anglo-Saxonism among old stock Americans to enact the Highly Restrictive Immigration Act of 1924. Which was the law of the land until 1965. For some of us, that's not that long ago. As I said earlier, Anglo-Saxonism was on the minds of a diverse crowd, even among the left, such as Jack London in the early 20th century. But it was also on the mind of J. Gresham Machen, the father of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. In his famous book, Christianity and Liberalism, published in 1923, he writes, "God grant that there may come a reaction and that the great principles of Anglo-Saxon liberty may be rediscovered before it's too late." The Anglo-Saxon ideal arguably lived on for decades, even after World War II, even in cinema, with actors Clark Gable, Jimmy Stewart, a Presbyterian, by the way, and Gary Cooper. As Tony Soprano once said, and I won't try to do the accent, "What happened to Gary Cooper, the strong, silent type? That was an American. He wasn't in touch with his feelings. He just did what he had to do." And then, of course, there's Gregory Peck and, of course, John Wayne. Let's suffice it to say that for most of our history, old stock Americans, which were both the majority of the population and of the elite, believed that American was a distinct ethnicity, or at least contained the core dominant ethnicity of American society, rooted in the old world, especially in an Anglo-Saxon myth, but generated in the new world around the time of the founding and early republic. This ethnos was not simply the big one among others, but that into which all others ought to assimilate. They rejected the melting pot idea, an early 20th century idea cooked up by a Jew in New York who despised the confident Anglo-Protestant establishment. The melting pot idea subverts traditional American openness. Our ancestors believed that the American core ethnicity, a people of particular dispositions, manners, and cultural inheritance, is best suited for the sorts of liberties recognized in the American founding. This view animated American politics throughout our history. As I said in my first line, nothing about our thinking on ethnicity is normal. But we must emphasize that Anglo-Protestantism is traditionally an open ethnicity. We've always held that non-Anglo-Protestants, can over time conform and become one of us. Dominant ethnicity is not opposed to assimilation. It is not a race essentialist ethnicity, nor something enclosed by genetic markers. People of non-British ancestry can become Anglo-Protestant culturally. Nevertheless, its openness is not openness for difference, but openness to the possibility of conformity. American openness says this: this land is our homeland, and we welcome you on the condition of conformity. Still, we must recognize, in general, that 20th century immigration, including Ellis Island immigration, has been bad overall for this country. Indeed, our sprawling federal bureaucracy, rooted in FDR's New Deal, came largely from the Catholic European immigrants' preference for the welfare state. Helen Andrews, writing at the American Conservative, says this: "The closer we look at the New Deal, the more we see just how deeply entangled immigration is with the growth of the welfare state. This preference endures, which explains why Roman Catholics vote for the Democrats far more than white Protestants. And while Roman Catholics since World War II have dominated the intellectual conservative scene, Roman Catholic energy now is on the side of welfarism, domestic interventionism, and European-style class struggle, exemplified by the Vatican Firsters at Compact Magazine. As shown earlier, immigrants do not shrug off the values of their ancestral homeland, and those who have strong family values will still vote for welfare programs and social services over universal moral concerns like abortion and homosexual marriage. When your heart is planted elsewhere, your main concern here is for the things of the body. Foreigners care more for free stuff than national greatness. Since Ellis Island immigration was white immigration, the old America, the America of the old right that opposed the New Deal, is not a white thing, but a distinctly American Anglo-Protestant thing, generated on these shores by a particular people. I'm not interested in a white nationalism, nor limiting immigration to white people. While white immigrants today will join white Catholics in voting for the Democrats. Rather, old America lives on, albeit imperfectly, among white evangelicals who, as a voting bloc, remain the lone bulwark against the complete destruction of old America. Though to be sure, they do not stand alone. Conservative Protestants from many backgrounds have joined us in our efforts. These people are one with us and must not be excluded, and we can work together with Roman Catholics. But the fact is, we cannot expect immigrants, no matter where they are from, whether from Western Europe or anywhere else, to affirm American political principles even after generations of residence. The heritage American and those consciously grafting themselves into that heritage are the last hope for old America. What is further recognized that we are a Protestant people, which makes America a Protestant country. We must act in public as Protestants again. We must be Protestant academics, Protestant politicians, Protestant ethicists, Protestant intellectuals, Protestant voters. We must restore our confident responsibility for the America that is ours. Shrugging off the Stockholm syndrome-like admiration we have for the Roman Catholic and Jewish thinkers, minorities in the Anglo-Protestant majority that have dominated movement conservatism and predictably were unable and largely unwilling to stop the slide of progress. To make America great again, America must again become explicitly and confidently Protestant again. To this day, the core culture of America endures, though it is under threat. Samuel Huntington rightly wrote that America's core culture has been, and at the moment is still, primarily the culture of 17th and 18th century settlers who founded American society. The central elements of that culture can be defined in a variety of ways, but include the Christian religion, Protestant values, Protestant moralism, a work ethic, the English language, British traditions of law, justice, and the limits of government power, and a legacy of European art, literature, philosophy, and music. All this must be reaffirmed and reinvigorated, and we are the people to do it. It must be and remain the norm of American public life. Let me conclude with Scripture. Revelation 7:9. After this I beheld, and lo, a great multitude, which no man can number, of all nations and kindreds and people and tongues, stood before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes and palms in their hands. Let me ask you a question. You, brother or sister, are in that multitude. Whom are you standing next to? Have you ever asked yourself that question? Which nation of that great multitude are you among in that verse? Some of you might be thinking, well, I'm a quarter Irish, so maybe I'll be among the Irish. Look, I'm a bit this and that too, but let me tell you whom I am standing next to. I'm next to John Winthrop, Cotton Mather, and Jonathan Edwards. I'm next to John Jay, John Witherspoon, and George Washington. I'm next to Benjamin Warfield, Stonewall Jackson, and Calvin Coolidge. I'm next to my friends Santiago Pliega, Antonin Scalia, and Clarence Thomas. And finally, I'm next to Billy Graham, Jimmy Stewart, and R.C. Sproul. These are my people. Who are yours? Well, that concludes my speech. Thank you for listening. It should come out in a text version, and when it does, I will put it in the show notes. So thank you for listening.